Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join the madness.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 696.
Today we have a very complex question from Jeannie, so I will be interrupting it at points to comment on it as we go, otherwise I won't be able to keep all of it in my head. Jeannie says,
"Can you talk about the cost in personal bandwidth when it comes to self-promotion? Usually creators aren't the types of people who have both skill sets. The introversion usually needed to produce engaging writing is often diametrically opposed to the extroversion that's needed to exploit or market it."
So this is a common perception, but it's not exactly true. What you need to be able to produce interesting writing is not introversion. It is an enjoyment of solitude. We talked about that a few days ago when we were talking about only children. But you will get a lot of introverts who are writers. You will also get a lot of very charismatic, outgoing cult leader types who are writers. And you will get the occasional writer, actually more than occasional, who is introverted, meaning that being around people exhausts them, but who is also highly charismatic. I've known more than a few, and it surprises me every time I run across one, because you don't think of these qualities as going together, but they really do, or they really can. And I don't know, genuinely, I am not sure whether that's an issue of they have trained themselves to be that outgoing, or they are just naturally that outgoing, but they're not fed by it, so to speak. There are a number of different kinds of promotion. Not all of them require being in person in front of other people. Not all of them require even being in front of other people on social media. So whether you're an introvert or an extrovert or a charismatic introvert or a really grumpy extrovert and you can't make that work for you socially, that happens too. There's going to be something you can do. Advertising and marketing is a very richly developed complex field, and you are probably doing yourself a disservice as a independent business person whose livelihood depends on people buying your stuff if you don't understand the advertising marketplace and how human psychology works and whatnot. Because this is a field that has been really aggressively developed, especially since the 1940s, and there is a lot of research, best practices, lots of literature on what kind of stuff works, what kind of techniques work to create a brand, to make sure that people remember your name, how to manage priming, how to manage pricing. People get PhDs in this kind of stuff. It's a real, genuine sociological field. And it's directly applicable to what we do. So if you're an introvert and you want to market yourself, read. Because you can find all sorts of hacks and adapt them to your situation. Continuing.
How has this necessity shifted over the years? In what ways has the market made self-promotion? In what ways has the market made self-promotion more of a requirement? Or have they? I've seen solid content producers flame out because of too much time spent on maintaining a growing fan base.
It hasn't. It hasn't made it necessary. What it's done is make it an option. The attractive thing about social media promotion and social media in general is that the cost of entry is zero or close to zero, or at least used to be. That's changing as everybody's monetization policies change. MailChimp just changed everything, and everybody's pulling out now. Patreon's just changed everything, and the platform is suffering for it. One of the problems with the crossover between tech and the arts, or tech and the press, is that the tech ethos developed in the late 90s, and I was there, I know, the tech ethos is based on finding nonlinear returns by doing something that revolutionizes a field. And in the early days, the kinds of stuff that was going on, even in the days of the bubble, the kinds of stuff that were getting funded were the things that, if they worked, had almost limitless potential in terms of upside. So VCs could afford to throw a lot of money at very stupid ideas on the off chance that they'd work, because they only needed one or two of them to work to secure their status as billionaires forever. That's where the current billionaire class came from. The current tech industry, post-crash and especially post-2008 crash, the current tech industry is still speaking that language, but what they're actually doing is they're still funding things at that level that have very limited potential markets. Things like digital media companies like Vice and Vox and BuzzFeed, or businesses like Uber and Lyft or Twitter. These things are funded out to the gills, way past the point where they could reasonably ever expect a return on the investment. Netflix is in this same situation. They are so overleveraged, it is only a matter of time before they go down, or before they sell themselves out to Disney, who's buying everything. The notion that transforming a business is enough to make you rich forever is founded on an idea that was popular in the 90s called first mover advantage. But if you look at the history of the industry, it's never the first mover who wins. It's the second. The first mover proves the market and usually goes bankrupt. MySpace, for example, LiveJournal. It's the second mover, the one that learns from the mistakes of the first mover, that generally figures stuff out. Facebook. This happened with IBM and Microsoft. So it's going to happen with Amazon and Netflix. Netflix is going to go away or is going to have to sell out, and Amazon will continue. Because Amazon did what none of these other businesses are doing. They built everything incrementally by funneling their profits back towards reinvestment instead of doing profit-taking along the way. And that is the way that sustainable businesses are built. The rest of these businesses are not sustainable, and that's why they're starting to nickel and dime everybody. And they started to nickel and dime everybody a few years ago, and it's just getting worse and worse. It's the root cause behind censorship wars and behind radical cultural polarization, because everybody's chasing clickbait, and everybody is afraid of any revenue going away because they're all in debt. So they're vulnerable to any pressure groups. They're also a little bit drunk on their own power, and they're incentivized monetarily towards pushing outrage and generating the kind of culture that eventually is biting them in the ass. And social media is directly in the middle of all of this. So social media has made it possible to connect with an audience for almost no cash outlay, or did for a while. It still does, but it's getting a little more difficult, both as the space becomes saturated and as these companies get more and more desperate for money. They do things like Facebook does now, which is the more successful you are, the less access they give you to your fans without paying for it. It's like a progressive tax on steroids. The moment you start to see any kind of success, they start nickel and diming you and frequently throttling your access to your customers anyway as a way of pumping more cash out of you. So anyway, that wasn't the trail I was expecting to go down. But what social media has done is it's made it possible for someone with no money to employ guerrilla marketing tactics on a broad scale. Most of what you see on social media is a domain-specific adaptation of techniques that were developed by romance writers in the late 80s and by indie filmmakers in the 90s. And those are both improvisations of guerrilla marketing tactics that were invented by indie filmmakers and small business people during the 60s and 70s. Social media allows you to take these tactics and use them to reach a vast audience. You used to have to do that through direct mail, which was really expensive. Now you can do it for no incremental cost, at least for the moment. Now what that does is, because there's no incremental cost and because you get the instant feedback from people, that has a real screwed up effect on your motivational structure. Because instant feedback is like a slot machine. It's addictive. It gives you that dopamine hit that you desperately, desperately want. So that sucks your productivity out because you're hitting the refresh button all the time. All that creative energy that you'd have going into making new content instead goes into fan relations, which you can vaguely justify as being important for your business, because on some level it is. But your personality is only going to go so far if you're not delivering the goods. And that's what social media personality after social media personality has figured out the hard way. So the trick to doing this without flaming out is to manage your time well. It's actually a two-part thing. The first is to manage your time well. Silo off the social media marketing and promotion stuff. Make the marketing a separate business department that occupies a different section of your day than your creative time. And the second part of that is you look for marketing activities which can become their own product line or income stream on their own. Look no further than Nike for this. Nike was the company, if I remember correctly, that first unlocked the potential of t-shirts. Nike makes shoes, and yet they sell for $30 or $40 t-shirts that have their brand name on them, which allows fans of the brand to identify each other in public by announcing it. But what is it? It's an advertisement. People are paying Nike for the privilege of advertising their shoes. There's a lot of opportunities to do that kind of thing. So the two things you want to do are figure out how to put a Chinese wall between your creative time and your marketing time, and how to make your marketing activities ends in themselves in terms of income generation. And those are the two tricks. And a lot of the personalities you've seen on social media that flame out are employing neither of them. Continuing.
I guess the root of the question is, how do you prepare for fame in whatever form it takes? I've seen what even mild approbation can do to people. If people who are putting themselves out there haven't thought through the consequences, they melt down pretty fast. How does one handle putting content out only to have it ignored or denigrated? What happens when you get a deluge of groupies but haven't established boundaries? How do you explore what boundaries to fix in advance if you don't know what the landscape might look like?
Well, this is the problem that everybody faces at some point. And it's a problem. I've watched acquaintance after acquaintance hit a certain level of fame and start pissing all over their own audience. You don't do that. The first thing you need is, all of these are actually boundary issues. And understanding what kind of game you're in is super important. When you put something out and it gets no reaction, yeah, it's dispiriting. But there's this old saw among professional writers that you can be dissuaded by a rejection note, you shouldn't be in this business. And today's equivalent of a rejection note is no sales and no press. The reason you shouldn't be in this business is that the arts are fucking brutal. It is a gambler's game in terms of what's going to hit the jackpot, if anything, in terms of how you've got to manage your cash flow in your business and your emotions. It's got all the downsides of a slot machine and not all of the same upsides. So your emotional boundaries around your work, treating your work product as a product, not as your baby, in your own head, is essential to survival. And I've watched some fairly successful authors start out thinking, oh, I could never treat my work with the callous attitude that these old pros have. And then the ones that survive are the ones that suddenly learn how to do that, because they discover they love writing enough that they're not willing to let themselves be put off by bad reviews or low sales or rejection notices. So on some level, you have to hold your audience in a little bit of contempt, at least insofar as you're not actually paying attention to their opinion. Now, you have to hold that in your head at the same point with never disrespecting your audience. That is really difficult for a lot of people who've had a little bit of success and get it into their head that their audience owes them something, either because they've given a lot of stuff away for free to build their brand or because they've just gotten used to the approbation. They start to believe their own PR, never noticing that the person you are in public, and I don't care who you are, this is always true, the person you are in public is at best an edited version of the real you. Most of the time, it's a character you play, even if you don't start out intending that to be the case. Most of the time, it's a character you play. The character can be more or less genuine. It doesn't have to be a deception or a lie. In a couple of cases of artists I know, it's genuinely a role they play. They work under pen names and they play this character who is this author person. And it works really well for them. And the audience is in on the joke because they know it's a pen name and everyone's okay with it. If you're using your real name, the lines can get a little more blurry. And you have to figure out ways to make sure that you're distinguishing what's going on, because a lot of weird stuff can happen. The first is that you can start to expect the attention and think you have a right to it. You don't. You are earning that attention, and if you don't keep in mind that you're earning that attention, you can start to treat people really poorly without even realizing it. Now, just like their attention, you're not entitled to their money. You have to earn that. And you have to keep that in mind, because even habitual bestsellers write the occasional turkey. Even the best writers in the world have books you've probably never heard of unless you're a devoted fan of that writer. Because the best writers in the world get that way by writing a lot of crappy books and learning their craft and developing their voice. You are not entitled to your audience's money. You're entitled to money that the audience wants to pay you for the books you write. Now, they're not entitled to steal your books, but they're not required to buy them either. And that's something you got to keep in mind, or you're going to start to resent your audience when you have released something they don't like. Now, the confounding factor here is the thing you've released that they don't like could be your best work. It could be the work that you've wanted to do your whole life, that you've struggled on for many, many years, but that you haven't been rewriting to death. It could be genuinely a towering artistic masterpiece, but if it's not what they're looking for, it's not going to do well. And you have to accept that from the get-go. Success is a fickle, fickle mistress, and the audience is very fickle. And to understand this, you have to look no further than what happens in every successful TV show that runs for several years. Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, which is going on right now, How I Met Your Mother, Star Trek The Next Generation, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Babylon 5, Lost, good ending or bad, and some of them had one, and some of Battlestar Galactica, some of them had one, some of them had the other. Once the audience gets to a particular point of investment, they believe that the show is theirs. And in some sense, it really is theirs. But they think that they can write it better than the showrunners. Maybe they could. But they don't actually have that right. It's not theirs to write. It's the showrunners to write. They are along for the ride. They can stay on or go off. They can like it or dislike it. But the one thing you must never do is let the audience write the story. Because the whole reason that stories work is you're giving the audience what they are not conscious of wanting. If an audience is conscious of wanting something, then what you give them in those lines will never satisfy, because it can never match the fantasy they've built up in their heads. The key to creative success is to give someone something they want in a form in which they don't recognize it. Because that creates surprise, delight, and investment. It's really difficult to do, which is one of the reasons that success, even for the best writers in the world, is hard to come by, at least on a grand scale. Now, the other thing you got to keep in mind is that with approbation and money and fame comes sex. And if you don't have a policy on how to deal with it out of the gate, you're going to get in trouble. You're going to get in trouble either because you take advantage in situations where it's not appropriate, because you employ your dating strategy when it comes to groupies, because you flirt more than your partner is comfortable with and you guys haven't talked about it beforehand, or because you are callous, rude, or otherwise insensitive about turning people down or managing situations so that you don't get hit on by people you don't want to get hit on by. You need to know what your policy is when you go out in public as an author, because fans interacting with you are not interacting with you. They are interacting with your public face. They don't know who you are. So they're very literally having a fantasy when they're with you, whether they're talking with you, whether you're having coffee, whether you're on a walk, or whether you're in bed. They are enacting a fantasy, even if it's not one they're seriously conscious of. And you have to be really careful when you're walking around other people's fantasies and private symbol vocabularies. Those parts of the human psyche, to my way of thinking, are sacred, and you shatter them at your peril. It's a crappy thing to do. So if you are going to keep your distance, you need to have a way to do so politely. And if you're going to engage on any level, conversational or sexual or anything in between, you need to know what your boundaries are and what your protocols are. And you may make some dumb mistakes along the way, and because this is an era of total surveillance and everybody weaponizing disappointment and misunderstanding, that can get dangerous in a way that it wasn't dangerous for people my age and older. So you need to be cognizant of that. People's relationship to authors who have touched their inner lives is... it creates a complicated set of power dynamics, because on the one hand, you have the power over them because you're kind of a totem in their personal pantheon. But on the other hand, they have the power over you because they hold your reputation in their hands, and they know it. And if you go into situations like that without understanding that those two things are almost always true at the same time, you're setting yourself up for a world of hurt. Now, this ties back into not crapping on your audience, because the one thing you don't have a right to do, as far as I'm concerned, is to destroy people's gods, unless they ask you to. I'll give you a really horrifying example. Marion Zimmer Bradley has now been outed by her children as being a serial child molester. Her husband died in prison, and she was on public record as having aided and abetted his pedophilic activities for years. So I'm not telling tales out of school here. Because I got to know her family and friends after she died, I was privy for 15 years to the whole sordid story before it came out in public. And I never said a word in public about it, or to fans, or anything, even though I had a front row seat and was personally involved in helping clean up some of the mess she made. She was a hell of a monster personally, but the reason I never said anything in public, and wouldn't if I had it to go back and do over again, is that I also know people who owe their writing careers to her. I also know people who have been able to recover their lives from exactly the kind of abuse she perpetuated on people because of the archetypes and the symbols and the narratives they found in her stories. And to come out and publicly shit on her would be to ruin those people's religion, and also to make professional colleagues of mine uncomfortable because they got their first paychecks from someone who was farming children for sex. If she had been alive and was actively doing it, that would be another matter. Then you go to the police, because that's a crime, and you don't make yourself party to that kind of stuff. But when it comes to her relationship with her fans, not my business, because the fans aren't relating to Marion the monster. They're relating to the author of The Mists of Avalon, the author of the Darkover novels, the person who woke their creative and mythological voice up inside of themselves. And I'm using Marion because she's a horrible example. She's the kind of person that you would want to call out even posthumously, because that's the kind of thing that almost everybody agrees is awful behavior and should not be tolerated. And it is, and it shouldn't. But even there, you destroy someone's image like that, and you're destroying the internal lives of the people who have been inspired by those books. When you interact with fans, whenever you interact with fans, you are engaging in kind of a religious activity. You are showing them some part of the man behind the curtain. You are a potent totemic figure in their mind, and you don't have the right to ruin that. And if you're the kind of person whose personality is suited to being disagreeable and nasty, then you have to either suppress it or go all the way the other way, like, for example, Harlan Ellison did, and make that your baseline public persona. Make it clear that if you interact with me in public, you're gonna get punched in the face, metaphorically speaking. Harlan was a disagreeable guy who liked pissing people off, and he realized that the only way he was ever going to survive as a professional with a public personality was to just be the personality in bright, vivid color. You can do that too, and that makes it a fair game because you're not behaving contrary to the persona. But you don't have a right to behave contrary to the persona. Now, it gets a little more interesting when you start to make friends who were once fans. At that point, you have a job of very gradually and in a deliberate way that doesn't create problems, moving from the persona to the person, showing who you are in a way that allows them to make the transition from you as the author I've idolized to you as the person who's now my friend. And that is a really difficult dance, and I don't know if I've got any advice for that, because I think it's the kind of thing that can only come through experience. But if you keep this other stuff in mind, it will help a lot. So that's that. Continuing.
As a writer in a world dominated by social media, how does one get traction but still maintain personal privacy?
Well, if I tell you that, you'll be able to find me.
And continuing, what are the common traps that we will all fall into? And how does one unfuck themselves from a situation but still retain general goodwill?
Well, okay, so back on the privacy thing, privacy's gone. I wish it wasn't. And there's ways that you can make yourself harder to find. But I genuinely am not going to go into them because, like I said, if I told you, you'd be able to use those to find me. And you know, I like having the option of inviting people to my house. I don't like them showing up unannounced. So I'm not going to go into that. But if you want to learn those tricks, check out some of the writings of Brooke McNanty and Edward Snowden and the writings of Laura Kipnis. I may be mixing the name up. The journalist who documented Snowden's defection. Check out their writings on how to maintain privacy, because they're very, very good at it and have managed to avoid the attention of governmental entities when they wanted to. So, you know, that's the highest level of privacy protection. That's where you can go. And there's some other lower level hacks you can use as well. But like I said, I'm not going to go into it because I use them. Now, as far as the common traps we fall into and how to unfuck yourself, a lot of the stuff I covered earlier would fall under the common traps. They all fall under two basic categories. One is believing your own propaganda and getting full of yourself. The other is wearing your heart on your sleeve. You can't do either one. If you do, you're going to react in ways that are publicly embarrassing. So you're going to have to build a thick skin in both senses of the word. Both a thick skin against praise and a thick skin against criticism, because people will be vicious as much as they will be laudatory. Sometimes more vicious than laudatory, and both tend to scale at the same rate. A undiscovered novelist is never the worst person in the history of the world for writing these things. They're simply spinning an ugly story that no one will be interested in. But a really popular novelist is the worst person in the history of the world for writing these things, and oh my God. So the positive and the negative tend to scale, and anytime the positive goes up, you should expect the negative to get more intense, because people like to tear down icons and totems, because it makes you feel, when you tear someone down like that, it makes you feel more powerful than them, and for a brief shining moment, you are. And so the incentives are against you if you're in the public eye. Yeah, how does one unfuck themselves? Frankly, duck your head down and shut up. The attention span of everybody on the planet is so damn short that all you gotta do is weather the storm and then pop up later, and the people who are still around will still be your fans and no one else will care. Unless someone's got a hard-on for destroying you and it's personal somehow, even if it's not directly personal, but they've made it personal for them. When you get those kinds of folks, I mean, there's nothing you can do about them aside from basically to ignore them. If they manage to make direct trouble for you in ways that start to broach the bounds of legality, you can sue them or you can prosecute them, and you should. One of the things that all the social media mobbing and whatnot that we've seen, and the moral panics and the witch hunts that we've seen going on the last few years have obscured is that most of this behavior is actually illegal. But nobody is using the existing legal structure to enforce their rights in situations like this because, frankly, it's expensive. And unless it's an open and shut case, a lawyer's not going to take it on contingency. An open and shut case with a reasonable expectation of getting paid whatever the judgment is. So having a legal fund is not a bad idea. But the more people start to enforce their rights under existing law, the less expensive it will be to do it, because at the moment, these laws apply, but there's not a lot of case law that shows exactly how they apply, hence the reason that lawyers are not willing to take stuff on contingency. But if you make yourself familiar with harassment laws and libel laws and the attendant case law and stalking and whatnot, you will be in a much better position to defend yourself legally when it's possible and necessary, and to let everything else roll off your back. Because you can't apologize to a witch hunt. First of all, it's never enough, because people who are out for blood, and this is the case in moral panics throughout history, you'll see it, if you want to be unpolitical about today's stuff, go back to the McCarthy hearings. The people who got up in front of Congress and admitted they were communists destroyed their own careers, and they also got nothing out of it, and they kept getting pilloried endlessly because they were now on record admitting that they were in the wrong and they were the bad guys. This always happens. The people who got up and defended themselves and saying, "I'm not going to say anything, ha ha ha, go f*** yourself," they got a lot of trouble too. Less trouble than in other moral panics in history, because they had stronger constitutional and legal protections, but they still got a lot of crap thrown their way, and some of them had major legal problems as a result of people taking revenge on them for failing to comply. And the third class of people said nothing. They went up, they said nothing, or they declined to appear. Some of them flouted congressional subpoenas, if I remember correctly. And in situations where there is a moral panic, or a witch hunt, or a bunch of people out to get you, there are only two sane options. Number one is to destroy the people that are after you, if you can, and if you can do so legally and ethically. And the other is to just disappear and let it blow over, because it will blow over, and any more now, in a couple of weeks. I mean, Harvey Weinstein is now on trial, but Harvey Weinstein only had to disappear for a year. And if he's not convicted, he's going to be back producing films, and if he is convicted, then once he gets out, he'll be back producing films, because he's good at what he does. And all the available evidence to the public says that not only was he a douchebag, he was a serious criminal. Mafia dons go in and out of jail and keep doing their business. The only way you can have your career seriously and permanently destroyed is if you're complicit in it. If you make the wrong political calculus and you've picked the wrong hill to die on. Pick the right hill to die on and you may never die. But no matter what the case is, if the mob comes for you, and, you know, not everyone's going to have the mob come for them, but anyone with a sufficient amount of popularity is at greatly enhanced risk. When the mob comes for you, the only smart way to go is to not be there. Like Mr. Miyagi said, best block, no be there. Block if you have to, disengage if you can, because if they don't have an active, responsive target who can keep their moral panic at the top of the news cycle, whether it's the small-scale social news cycle or the genre news or the community news or the state and national news, if they don't have a target that can keep their name at the top of the gossip list, they'll move on to someone who can. I mean, Ronan Farrow, who outed Harvey Weinstein and did the public a service by it, is a gossip monger, and Harvey was not his first target. He was just the first one that stuck. He shopped around for years doing pieces on different people of varying degrees of credibility until he got Harvey. And kudos to him for getting Harvey, but he was looking for a target. And if someone else who he went after on less evidence had engaged, that would have made his career the way Harvey wound up making his career. There are people in the world whose job it is to elevate themselves at the expense of other people. And moralistic mobs, no matter what the moral panic is, are always led by people who make their names tearing other people down. The entire ecology depends on the complicity of targets in playing out the drama. So don't. So that's what I got for you. Treat people ethically, behave decently, be mindful of the totemic aspects of the interaction, and when the mob comes for you, keep your head down and never piss on your fans. Thanks for sending it in, and I'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.